It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, would a fee on hybrid vehicles in Wisconsin help fix the transportation budget? We'll find out why our guest says, not really, no. First, tensions between the United States and North Korea got even worse this weekend after a nuclear test from the isolated Asian country. North Korea's nuclear aspirations have been closely monitored by the international community. So what does this test mean for North Korea and the rest of the world? How will the international community respond if North Korea continues its pursuit of nuclear weapons and missiles that can carry them? Scott Snyder is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the program on U.S.-Korea policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of the new book, South Korea at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rival Powers. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Sure, glad to be here.
Well, North Korea has done nuclear tests in the past. Can you talk about the significance of this one, this what appears to be more powerful nuclear device?
That's right. The North Koreans claimed to have tested a thermonuclear device this time, and the estimates of yield from this test have been about 5 to 10 times greater than previous tests. So we see that North Korea is making progress. The significance of North Korea possibly having thermonuclear capability would mean that if they launched a missile in the direction of another country, the necessity of accuracy would be less because a thermonuclear device could wipe out a larger area. And so that redresses one element of weakness in North Korea's effort to try to develop a strike capability. So basically the main obstacle that North Korea still needs to overcome in order to be able to launch a weapon in the direction of the United States is really re-entry as part of an international continental ballistic missile package. And the U.S. options for trying to stop that, obviously time is limited as they make progress. And so I think that the focus of the administration has turned to both the U.N. Security Council, but also looking at additional unilateral sanctions measures that could be placed against North Korea. I'm sure that there's probably some kind of exploration of ways to improve diplomatic communication with North Korea. And then obviously the last resort option would be to try to use military force against North Korea if it were clear that the North Koreans were actually going to try to strike the United States with a nuclear capability.
Let's talk about that sanctions idea. There have been a lot of sanctions against North Korea over the years. Is there a regime of sanctions that could make a difference at this point, that North Korea would stand up and take notice and actually dial back their nuclear ambitions?
Sanctions by themselves have never been, I think, effective in causing a change in direction. It's going to have to be accompanied by some kind of diplomatic effort. But sanctions are one way of trying to put pressure on the regime. The problem in this case, I think, is that the main source or motive by Kim Jong-un to pursue a nuclear capability, I think, stems from his own sense of vulnerability. What we've seen over the course of the past 5 years is that the nuclear program has been a source of domestic legitimation for him, and the North Koreans continue to state that they'll meet pressure with pressure, and then they're not going to give in to that kind of sanctions pressure. They do have a kind of counteroffer out there, which is it feels like a kind of blackmail offer to some extent. Essentially, it's the call upon the U.S. to drop its hostile policy toward North Korea, at which time it would be possible from a North Korean perspective to engage in some kind of mutual arms control discussion.
Looking at North Korean motivation more, as I understand it, this has been an official kind of idea from North Korea saying basically, hey, look, Saddam Hussein in Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons. He's dead. His regime is gone. Muammar Gaddafi in Libya didn't have nuclear weapons. He's dead. His regime is gone. Why on earth would we give up our nuclear weapons given that precedent? Is that part of the thinking in North Korea?
Absolutely. I think that Kim Jong-un has decided, in fact, that North Korean media continuously cites those examples for why North Korea wants to hold on to this capability. And I think that Kim Jong-un has decided that he wants to be too nuclear to fail, given the track record of regime failure in places like Libya and then in Iraq.
We're talking to Scott Snyder from the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the book South Korea at the Crossroads, looking at the latest from North Korea, nuclear tests, international reaction. Want to give a listen to U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. She says we're basically running out of diplomatic ways of dealing with North Korea. Here's a little bit of what she's had to say.
The time has come to exhaust all of our diplomatic means before it's too late. We must now adopt the strongest possible measures. Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. He wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited.
So Kim Jong-un not using nuclear weapons just for defensive purposes, begging for war. What do you make of what you've heard from Nikki Haley?
Well, I think what Ambassador Haley was really trying to dramatize the idea that we're running out of time and that this is a matter of greatest urgency. And, of course, it's necessary to try to build a sense of pressure in the international community in order to be able to pass any kind of additional sanctions resolution. But one other aspect of her comments that I think, you know, is interesting is related to the question of does North Korea understand the idea behind mutual assured destruction. If, in fact, they're looking for a defensive deterrent, we can certainly understand why North Korea might feel vulnerable in a world where they have no allies and the U.S. has nuclear weapons. But they've also threatened to use nuclear weapons for offensive purposes, and that's problematic. It has raised a lot of questions, I think, in policy circles about whether any kind of Cold War formula for mutual assured destruction would be able to hold with somebody like Kim Jong-un.
Right. The concern would be that if North Korea were to invade South Korea, I mean, they're still at war technically. The first element of that could be a nuclear strike, then followed by a land invasion?
Yes, and also the possibility that they would continue to threaten use in ways that are irresponsible or shorten the ladder of escalation. I mean, as it is, if North Korea has a capability to strike the United States, and we're not quite there yet, it means that any sign that North Korea is moving in that direction is going to heighten the prospect that the United States is going to take preemptive action. And then North Korea knows that, and so they're looking at how can we preempt U.S. preemption. And so this dramatically raises the risks of miscalculation and possible mistakes between the two countries.
We've heard from the White House possible trade sanctions against countries that don't strictly enforce trade sanctions with North Korea, stopping trade even, and that includes mainly China, not just China, but mainly China. Is that a plausible threat?
I do believe that the U.S. Treasury has the capability to impose what is called secondary sanctions against mostly Chinese customers of North Korea. And, of course, this would create complications in the U.S.-China relationship. It's possible that the U.S. could take some pretty expansive measures in that area, but it still doesn't solve the fundamental problem that we really need to have some more enhanced form of communication, leader to leader. You know, some people have compared this North Korea crisis to the Cuban Missile Crisis, but at least at that time, we know that the President of the United States and the leader of the Soviet Union were in communication with each other. But with Kim Jong-un, we really haven't established anything that looks like effective leader-to-leader communication.
Finally, I wanted to ask about South Korea. We've heard, unrelated to this, the possibility of the U.S. canceling a trade agreement with South Korea, questions about how well we're coordinating with South Korea when it comes to North Korea. How do they fit into this?
Well, South Korea is the potential victim of any kind of military conflict between the U.S. and North Korea. They would be the ones that would suffer from North Korean retaliation the most. From a strategic perspective, it really doesn't make sense to raise issues related to trade differences between the U.S. and South Korea in this kind of way at a time when you're trying to address the North Korean threat. And so I think that suggesting that the South Koreans are focused on appeasement rather than focusing on coordination effectively, you know, given the high stakes that they have in avoiding conflict, is counterproductive to our broader interest in trying to deal with the North Korea threat.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, glad to be with you.
That's Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the new book, South Korea at the Crossroads. He joins us today to talk about the nuclear test North Korea conducted this weekend and U.S. diplomacy moving forward.